Round and Round, that's the Sugar Babes. See, I'm writing them down now. I'm way ahead. You're listening to Walk in My Shoes Radio. 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. We're joined by hairdresser extraordinaire. Hairstylist. Artiste.
Anything like that. Perfect.
Sheen Sharkey, all the way from Stillorgan originally, I believe.
Yes, yeah, still in Stillorgan.
Come nice and close to that microphone
so we
can hear you.
Strayed far.
Very good. Well, thanks for joining us this morning. And you might say, why are we doing an item about hairdressing? Well, why shouldn't we do our hairstyling?
Why shouldn't we always talk about hairstyling?
Hair is very important. Styling. See, I'm writing down the different terms now and get myself into trouble. Not just the hairdresser. It's all sorts of things as well. Well, one of the reasons that we wanted to talk about it was the connotations of how hair is viewed. That's one of the things as well. You have clients who come to you. And let's start with one of the obvious things, where someone loses their hair because of the medication they're on, whether that be alopecia or whether it be chemotherapy.
Yeah.
So what's the first thing you do when you see somebody who's coming in who's losing their hair?
Well, people who have just been given a very sad diagnosis are often feeling very emotionally unstable, I suppose, and they come in, and even though in the bigger picture what they're looking at, like, their hair is not the most important thing really, they've a lot to go through, but the losing of the hair can be one of the main things that can really affect them, and the thought of losing their hair can be huge for people. So they will come in to me a lot of the time and say, I've just been given this diagnosis, I'm going to lose my hair, what are we going to do? And I'm so used to it now that, like, sometimes people come in with long hair and the hair is their thing, and they think, let's go for a bob first, and then maybe in 2 weeks I'll come back and we'll get like a pixie cut, and in my head I'm thinking, you're probably going to get one haircut and then the hair will be gone. So it's a very quick procedure. It doesn't take months and months for your hair to fall out. It falls out very quickly, and usually you just don't really get a chance to try out all your haircuts that you might think you want to. And I think once it starts to fall out, people just come to terms with it quite quickly and then end up just shaving their head, and they get their wig, and then they just move on with life. But it is a hard thing to come to terms with your hair.
So do you work in a salon? Do you work privately? How do you work?
So now I work with brides. So I work just with private clients, but I would have worked in a salon for years, for 10 years. And I had a lot of ladies who would have come in over those 10 years having had this cancer diagnosis, and then going through the first stage of them losing their hair, and then them coming back to me when their hair starts growing back, which I love. That's like a brilliant stage. Their hair is coming back. It's not the same as it used to be, which can be quite empowering for women. They're like, I don't need my long hair and I'm fine without it. And they try new styles and they maybe stick to their new style. They don't go back to their old hair. But I love that stage when the hair is coming back. It's such a privilege to be part of that for people.
Let's just find out a little bit about you so we can just place where your experience would be. So how old are you, approximately?
Approximately 40, sadly.
You don't look it, you see.
No,
that's
I'm
the thing.
Very young looking.
That's the thing. Well, just to get an age group as well, and you're married and you have two children, isn't it?
Yes, two children.
As well. And you've been, how long have you been in the hairdressing business?
I've been
hairstyling business
since 1999. I was old starting, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've done other things as well.
Yeah.
So when people come into you, and you're trained to be a hairstylist, and you get used to talking to people, obviously, in the chair. How's your holidays? How's the kids?
You'd want to be that sort of person. I think you have to be obviously good at hair, but you also have to be quite a personable person, because you're one-on-one with people all day long. You have to enjoy chatting to people.
Do you remember the first time you dealt with a patient who was, or the client who was losing their hair?
I do remember the first time, because it was one of my regular clients. And you see your clients, sometimes you see your clients maybe twice a year, but then you have your regular clients who you see every 6 weeks for their haircut and maybe every week for their blow dry. And usually those very regular clients would be your older ladies, because they probably have more money. But they come into you so regularly, you get to know them so well. And I remember my client coming into me and she just didn't look herself. And I thought, oh, what's wrong with Marianne or whoever? And then she told me that she'd had a cancer diagnosis, and I'd never dealt with this before. I was quite young. I didn't know anyone who'd had cancer, and I just thought, oh my God, what am I going to say to her? And then I just thought, no, you know, I know her. I know her so well. Like, she's feeling sad. I'm just going to reassure her. I'm just going to listen to her and just talk to her about it. And then we cut her hair quite short that time. And then I didn't see her for a while, and I often wondered how she was. And then she came back with her very short, different textured kind of hair that a lot of people get after they've had chemo. And then we just worked on getting that back to kind of her old style again. But it was huge for me. I found it really difficult and I felt so sad for her. But now I've dealt with people so often that I'm kind of used to it now, and just sort of know what to say to people.
So
I suppose,
what do you say?
Or what not to say. I feel like, you know, if you're someone's sister or someone's mother, you need to sit down with them and really talk. I'm just their hairdresser. I just really need to listen. I think all anyone needs is someone to listen to. I'm out of their little circle of friends and their family. I'm not someone who's going to judge them. I don't know them well enough to go off telling anyone about anything. I just have to listen. And a lot of the time people would just come in and I would just listen to them and just give my feedback. Like, I'm not qualified in any way to do any kind of psychology, but just listening, I think, is the key.
Yeah, but you do sound like you are qualified from experience.
I suppose I'm qualified. As in, I've talked to a lot of people over the years, and I would at least be able to say, look, I've seen so many people go through this. This isn't so hard. Like, you'll be fine, things like that, and just be there for them. But, I suppose I think just listening. I'm kind of a patient person. I quite like just to listen.
So what kind of things do you say to people who come in and say, look, I'm about to go through chemotherapy. What do you say?
Well, I definitely would say that although the hair is a huge deal. I can't imagine being faced with losing my hair, but it really isn't on the grand scheme of things. It's not what's hugely important, and your hair will come back. And a lot of people find that when their hair goes, it's actually quite liberating. And there's amazing wigs out there. There's amazing hairdressers who deal specifically in wigs and helping people with their wigs. And it's really... it'll be fine.
So just in terms of practical terms then, if you've got long hair and this looks like it's coming down the tracks, what do you recommend?
I would recommend, just if you've got very long hair, just to cut it into a shorter style, because I imagine, and I think I've heard people say before, that when very huge chunks of hair come out, it can be a little bit more dramatic than if small, short hair comes out. So I think people cling on to their hair for a little while in the hope that maybe it won't happen to them. And there are people who get the cold cap treatment, so their hair won't.
Do you want to explain what that is for people who don't know what that is?
So during chemotherapy, you can have an extra treatment, which is called a cold cap. And I don't know the technical ins and outs of it, but it's basically a cold cap that they put on your head during your treatment.
It's like a rubber, what's the best word? It's like a bald cap if you were in theatre and you were putting on something to cover your head completely. Or if you're getting highlights, so you pull the hairs through.
Yes.
Except it's refrigerated.
And it keeps the follicles
cool. Because that's one of the things that happens with the temperature and the changes is that they heat up, the protein gets denatured and the hair falls out. It's just something...
So it holds onto your hair.
It helps. It helps. Keeps the head cool.
It doesn't keep all of everybody's hair, but it definitely keeps...
It helps. It helps. Keeps the head cool.
It doesn't keep... all of everybody's hair. Was a bridesmaid at a wedding, and they told me that one of the sisters had cancer, so you know her hair was, and I was looking around thinking, where is she? Because I was totally expecting it to be somebody with absolutely no hair. And then she sat down and said, oh, by the way, I had cancer. And I was like, oh, like you've all your hair. And she said it wasn't the same as it was before, but she still had her hair, so she could have the hair done for being bridesmaid for her sister. And I was like, do you think it makes a huge difference having your hair? And she said, huge. Like, when I'm in the supermarket now, she had two small kids as well, or three maybe. She said, people don't look at me with pity now. They don't know what I've been through. Whereas I feel if I had no hair, people would look at me. So it just shows that having hair makes such a difference. So when you're going to lose it, it can be a really scary prospect.
Well, let's talk about depictions of hair in movies and stuff like that. But let's take a little break and some music. Okay. We'll come back to it in a few minutes. Talking to Sheen Sharkey.
The look you gave, don't you hear that rhythm? Can you show me how we can escape? I'm
was trying to hide. I'll forget what I've done. I'll be redefined.
For World Mental Health Week, this is Walk In My Shoes Radio, broadcasting live from St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, Dublin 8.
And we are live in the lobby here of St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. You can hear trolleys going by with files on them and people coming in and out, and friends and family coming in and out as well. So don't worry about the noise in the background. That's what that is. We're right in a glass bubble right in reception. So if you're coming in this way, do wave in the window and say hello to us as well. We're talking to Sheen Sharkey, who's hairstylist.
Hair artiste.
I did say hairdresser at the start. I've been beaten around the place
That's
four
fine.
Times.
No, I never did.
We talked about how you might deal with somebody who's losing their hair, whether it be from alopecia or whether it be from chemotherapy as well. Something you mentioned to me as well was the depiction of hair in movies. So when somebody is in good form and everything is working out well, their hair is lustrous and shiny, and somebody wants to depict mental illness or something wrong, hair is shaved.
I see that so often. I mean, maybe I'm just looking at hair in particular all the time, but they use it in movies and in TV to really enforce the trauma that somebody is feeling. Like, you see it in Britney Spears, for example. She was obviously not feeling very well for a long time, but as soon as she shaved her head, everyone was like, oh my God, Britney, she must be bad. And in 13 Reasons Why, did you watch 13 Reasons Why?
No.
So the young teenage girl, she decides, and she's going to give she's having a bad time, she decides she's going to give it all one more chance. She gets herself a new hairstyle, and she's like, this will do it, this will make me strong again. And it actually backfires because she ends up getting bullied for, well, everything.
That's a series on Netflix, isn't it?
Yes. And it's all about this girl and her emotional well-being, but her hair really made a difference, and she thought it might help, and it didn't. She ended up getting bullied for that too. But then in other ways, you see Lady Mary in Downton Abbey. Do you watch Downton Abbey?
Oh, yes.
Oh, God, yes. where she just really wants to be ahead of her time and look strong and, wants to be like one of the men, and she gets a very trendy new haircut. She gets a bob when everyone would have
had
long hair.
She's like, before the flappers were there.
Yeah, and the reaction is huge. Everyone's like, oh my God, Lady Mary's cut her hair. Like, it's huge, and that just shows how hair really reflects and can really portray someone's emotional state, and they use it a lot.
It's interesting, a colour change is a massive thing for a woman.
Yeah.
Not so much for men. Men don't tend to change the colour of their hair as much, although the odd time you do see somebody coming in who was very grey and
sometimes is now. Sometimes not great. But see, Tom Jones, for example, he always had his hair dyed, and he let it go, and everyone was like, he looks amazing. He looks so much better.
And Marcy Whelan, about 10 or maybe even 15 years ago, decided, that's it, no more, I'm going to become the Silver Fox. And he looks great.
He actually got some
work done, hair transplants done on the front. He was very open about it.
Yeah,
and I was in studio with me last week, and his hair looks amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
It can really help your confidence. I think it must be hard for men as well. I don't think it is all women. Like, I think it's easy for men to be able to shave their heads, and that suits a lot of people, so that's great. But I think a lot of men have a hard time when they start to go bald.
I have some friends
that really struggle with that. It's hard, really hard. And you kind of expect that men should be fine, but there's such a trend for men's hair now. Like, long hair is cool, and footballers, all have really amazing haircuts, and then you're going bald, and you're like, I have no choice now. That's been taken from me.
You might maybe be able to answer this question. I know you don't specialise in hair pieces or wigs. Not for me.
Did you answer?
I'm not good looking. I haven't got an athletic body, but I kept my hair bizarrely at the moment. At the moment. But is there a new type of wig for men? I see using a glue.
I don't know anything about that, to be honest. I've never seen wigs for men. But there's definitely products you can use. There's like fiber products where you sprinkle these sort of fibers through your hair if you're feeling a bit sparse around the top and it fills in the gaps. So I've seen that.
I know. Bruce Willis used to colour in his scalp.
Yeah, it's pretty much that, is those fibre things. But they work. I'd be all over it. I wouldn't be ashamed to use that if I felt conscious of my hair. Go for it.
Excellent. Yeah. Now, so we talked about people, what they should do with their hair, and what you might do, and maybe finding the right person to do your hair.
Yeah.
When you're feeling a bit vulnerable, I think it's important as well.
Yeah, like I find it quite easy to deal with my clients who've had difficult times, and I don't think all hairdressers would. If you don't have a regular hairdresser or you don't have someone who you particularly enjoy sitting with, it's probably not going to be a great experience to go in and tell them that you're going to lose your hair. They might not know how to react and it could be awkward. But there are hairdressers who specialise in cancer patients. They know exactly what to do. They have an area of their salon which will be closed off. They'll take you in there. They have ways. I know my auntie's just been through cancer and she was with Aidan Fitzgerald in Blackrock, and he's an amazing way with people. He's done it for years. He has a little area. He brings you in, shave their head, have their wig ready. It's all dealt with amazingly. There's another place called Roaches. They specialise in this. So if you don't have a regular hairdresser you feel like you can talk to, there are really good people out there.
Yeah, and the Irish Cancer Society has a list of
they
those people as well.
Exactly.
Get in touch with them. Can I talk just back to you? How do you deal with that though? You obviously, some of the people they're going through, whether it be cancer related or hair related, maybe it's not hair related, and they're confiding in you about problems with their family and stuff. Do you take that away with you? How do you
sometimes
deal
I do.
With that?
Like honestly, some of my clients are like my friends now at this stage, and I feel so sad. Like I had a client come in and he had his shades on, and I was like, oh hi, how are you? The usual haircut. And he took his glasses off and he obviously looked so sad, and I was like, what's wrong? And like, I see my gents every 4 or 5 weeks, so I was so worried about him. I thought, what's wrong? And his mother had just died and he was getting the haircut for the funeral, and I just couldn't stop thinking about him because I know him so well, and I thought, oh God, how sad for him. Like, so I do sometimes take it away with me, but to be honest, a lot of the time people just talk, I just listen, and then I'll move on to my next client, and I won't think about them. I won't go off talking about them to anyone else. It's just, I know people just need to offload.
And so you're confident.
Just listen to them and then they'll go off and I'll see them the next time.
When you go to there's a question, when you go to people's houses for a bridal, the morning of a wedding, is that what you call it? The bridal morning?
The morning of a wedding.
The morning of a wedding. Yeah. The morning of a wedding. Do you ever see conflict in the house? Do you ever see murder?
A bit. I never seen murder. Not yet. Nearly though, I would say.
Really?
I
love this bit. Go ahead.
I love weddings. Like absolutely obsessed. Just outside of the hair. Like,
how many have you had yourself?
I've been married 6 times.
Oh right, okay. Yeah,
so
love
all
them.
Been fine.
Love wedding cake.
They're all fine. No, I've only had one, sadly. No, not sadly, brilliantly. Oh my God, that's not right. No, that's moving on.
Her husband's name is Kevin.
Moving
go ahead.
On. Hi Kevin. Love you. Moving on.
Tell us about the bride, give us a story of some sort.
I just love to sit there and watch the family dynamics. It's really funny. Like, a lot of people are just completely normal, just like me. And there's also always a little bit of tension. But you do see sometimes, you know, a little bit of mother-in-law tension maybe, or you know, two sisters who are just getting on each other's nerves, or maybe the bride has just been, it's tense, like it's hard. You're organizing a really big event.
What do you do when the bride is sitting in the chair and she bursts into tears? What do you do?
That has happened, where people have just been so emotional and they finally sit down for a second, because you can't get up and run around when you're getting your hair done. You have to sit down. Usually someone will give you a glass of water or something, and then you just go, oh my God. But again, I just listen. I don't know what I do. I just listen.
And what about too much champagne?
I have seen that too. Coffee? I definitely recommend not drinking too much champagne. It can get carried away though, because you're sipping and you're nervous and you just keep drinking, you keep putting it down and picking it up and you don't know how many you've had. But I've seen it all.
My wedding photos in the limo when we were heading from the church to the reception, they gave us a glass of champagne. Just one little glass of champagne. My cheeks went red, and all the wedding photographs just two
like
red
rosy.
Cheeks.
Yeah.
There you go.
Probably shouldn't have had it. Should have avoided it.
No, never. And I never did again subsequently in all the marriages I've had.
Never drank again.
Never drank again. Yeah. Sheen, thanks so much for coming in.
No,
if people want to find you and they want to avail of your services, or even just find out what you do, where will they find you?
Well, I have a website. It's my name, SheenSharkey.com. So that's SIAN. That's how you spell Sheen, believe it or not. SheenSharkey.com. And I'm on Instagram, Sheen Sharkey Hairstylist, Facebook and Twitter. But
I'm not so we'll find you. It's interesting the way you spelled your name there and kind of with gritted teeth went, that's how you spell it.
Well, I just get called all sorts, so I don't mind at all. I'll answer to anything beginning with S.
I was in we'll try that out off air.
I missed
a flight and I was at the Delta hub in the US and they were screaming people's names, trying to get them to get the desk, and they were screaming for Seamus Brian. And I was going, if Seamus Brian doesn't go up there, I'm going to box the head off him. And then I realised, that's Seamus Byrne. That's me.
Well, that happens to me a lot, but I usually get the hairdresser. Ask the hairdresser, because they can't remember my name. Anyway, it's Sheen. Charlie Sheen.
Thanks so much for coming in. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And you come across as being someone who's very empathetic, by the way. Really do.
Thank you very much.
Really, really do.
Thank you.
We're going to take some music. We're going to be talking to Dr. Coleman Nocturne in about 3.5 minutes. We're going to take some music. We're going to be... There we go. That's Beyonce, Crazy in Love. That's an old track, seemingly, by the way. Coleman Doctor joins us here on Walk In My Shoes Radio. It's heading for about 27 minutes to 11 o'clock here. We've got till 11 o'clock. We're going to have music in between, but we've got lots to talk about, Coleman. Good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you, Shane.
Well, you had to come in because you work here.
It's true, yeah. No hiding today.
We've spoken to you over the course of the last few years when we've been here. We've spoken to you. I've heard you on RTE programs, News Talk. You've been around as well. First of all, we were talking to a psychotherapist earlier, but I get confused. Your exact title, come on, give it to us now.
The full title is a psychoanalytical psychotherapist, but psychotherapist is fine. But basically, the psychoanalytical piece is to do with psychoanalysis. So it's the notion that our unconscious has a role in our emotions and feelings and thinking and behavior. So it's about incorporating that into the therapy. But I primarily work with children and adolescents, and some young adults. So that's my job title. I work half time here, and then I work as assistant professor in Trinity College Dublin, teaching on the child and adolescent psychotherapy program, or master's program.
So you're teaching other people to into the profession as well?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I love teaching. It's one of the parts of the job that I really enjoy. So I've been doing that for the last number of years. So I have the nice split between the clinical and the academic side.
So you brought out a book, how long ago now?
2015,
a book called Cop On.
That's right.
And it was about children and screens and dealing with children and technology and all sorts of things, but primarily dealing with children. I have to say, I found it very useful for me, and I've referred it, given it to a couple of friends of mine who are not even having difficulties, just trying to parent on a day-to-day basis. You're a parent as well.
I am.
How many do you have?
I have three children.
You have three children, and how old? Just approximately
ages? 7, 5, and 2.
7, 5, and 2. So you're dealing with the full gamut. You haven't made the teenage years yet. But you were a teenager yourself, so you have some experience.
And I suppose the bulk of my work is with teenagers, so that's kind of the other angle I come at it. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's become, and I suppose one of the topics I want to talk to you today is about screens. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, when I spoke to you 2 years ago, when I spoke to you 3 years ago, this changes all the time. There's a headline today which I want to read out to you, and I don't know if you're going to be shocked by this. I assume you're not. It's in the Daily Telegraph, it's on page 6. It says, "Steep rise in sexual assaults by children." Okay. Uh-huh. Internet pornography blamed as 30,000 offences, including rapes at school, are reported to police. And this is being linked to children's access to sexual content on the internet. Does that surprise you, that statistic?
Not a lot. No, it's disappointing and scary without being surprising. I mean, there's no particular evidence to suggest that pornography has an impact on childhood sexual behaviour, because the ethics of doing a study like that would mean exposing children to pornography as kind of test cases. So it's impossible to do that study. But what we do know is that there's a rising incidence of perpetrators of sexual abuse who are under the age of 18. And the Children at Risk inventory it must be 3 years now, reported that there was a 42% increase of calls to their line around young people under the age of 18 who were perpetrators of sexual abuse. Now, the tie into that and technology is that obviously children's access to pornography is an issue, and that's something that comes up in your clinical work regularly. Parents who are concerned that their child has accessed inappropriate material online, and it's vastly different. The urge to look at something pornographic as a teenager is no different to when you and I were teenagers, but the access is completely different, and that means that you're never more than 2 clicks away from any sort of a graphic image. If children and young people who are interested or concerned or worried or intrigued about their sexuality go to Pornhub or YouPorn or whatever it is for their sexual education, they will understand that what they see is not just two people in an act, but that's a relationship. So they do understand that that must be what intimacy is. So you have 14 and 15 year olds who are then going to the teenage disco and imitating what they see as something normal. So in many cases where you'd see those things, it may indeed be an act of misadventure, but nonetheless has grave consequences for both young people involved. So the idea that if children's only access to the story of what it is to be intimate and in a relationship comes from that side, then they're going to think that that's normal. So what you've got to do is we have to have another discourse alongside that, which talks about this is what intimacy is, this is what relationships is. Pornography is not real, it is built on a fantasy. And, you know, if pornography reflected real life, it wouldn't sell. And so the idea is that in schools and things, we need to move away from STDs and pregnancies and actually talking about what is a consensual relationship, what is an actual intimate relationship, and what are the ins and outs of being able to live with somebody who involves a degree of trust, it involves fidelity, and it involves a really hard-working companionship. If children don't are not exposed to that or are only exposed to one side, then they will think that is the norm. And so for that reason, the goalposts have shifted. And that's perhaps a contribution to why we have headlines, unfortunately, that we have there.
Just to get away from just to do a different side to it, consent is something that's become more to the fore in the last couple of years because of various criminal cases that have been taken as well. And you know, in colleges, we're talking about classes for, I know Trinity ran them, I think UCD ran them as well, and other colleges have run them as well, and say, what is consent? And when is somebody consenting to sex? And these are primarily, and they're 100% aimed at men. And,
sure.
And at women in a different way, but at men saying, you need to know when there's consent and when there's not consent on this. But there is an implication for, you know, like, you've got sons, I have a son, he is going to be a teenager in just a couple of years as well. And there is a chance that he will end up, not him particularly, but a child like that, with criminality because of something they've seen on the internet. They decide that that's okay. It becomes an issue as well. So this is quite serious. As well as for their well-being, there is a chance that they could end up before the courts with these things.
For sure. And it's not a question of your child going out looking for pornography. Often it's the time that will pornography find them. From the point of view of the study in the UK last year, said about 56% of children between the ages of 11 and 14 had accessed hardcore pornography, and that's completely different. It's a different world to what we're used to before. But the notion of pornography plays with the role of consent. It plays with hostility, violence. All these notions are tied into the storylines to make them graphically more appealing.
But that is appealing to humans. I mean, we read, if you look back at novels that we've read, Stephen King, let's just for an example, sexual violence in those, outward violence as well, and he sells in the millions. So as humans, we are attracted to that.
For sure.
Content.
If we go back to the notion of the unconscious, which we were talking about before, we all have a shadow. I mean, the shadow side is the part of us that gets gratified by, you know, looking at a car accident and slowing down to turn. That we are appealed to unconsciously, perhaps, the wrong side of the tracks, and that, you know, there is a gratification in that. What the internet does, it allows the shadow to play. And in terms of, if you think about the psychology of trolling, you know, people who are setting up anonymous accounts just to hurl abuse at people, and the group think, where you'd have people in a, perhaps in a very tense football match, who they might be solicitors and doctors, and they will shout hurling abuse, and they can act in a certain way because the group think and the social milieu allows that. In some respects, the internet, because it doesn't have an ethical format to it, it allows our shadow to come out and be, I suppose, encouraged and flourished. Some people would say we need that, and over-repression is a difficulty. And in terms of, if we think about sexuality within Irish culture, there was a time there it was so taboo that it was unhealthy. So we grew up with these complexes about our bodies and complexes about intimacy. Perhaps the dial has shifted too much in the other direction now, where I suppose children are exposed to a very sexualized and pornified culture, where that now is becoming the norm. And it's really difficult to get that balance right, but it's a balance we have to invest in trying to get right, because it's too serious. The fallout is too big.
So again, and I don't mind using my children as an example, they have essentially free access to the internet.
You're never more than two clicks away from pornography. There's nothing in the way of an 11-year-old accessing pornography that can verify that it's an 11-year-old accessing the pornography. So they can click into any site they wish in the same way that you or I or anyone else is. And that lack of structure, I guess, is the appeal of the internet. That's why we love it. It's uncensored, it's unregulated, but it is also, the danger is that it's unregulatable. And with every convenience comes risk.
Okay.
And that's part of the dilemma.
So two things we can talk about is, one is you were talking about a two-track approach. In my head it was a two-track. One is that we need to get the schools involved and we need to, and what a parent can do. So I want to talk about the other dialogue. There's one dialogue goes on with their friends about sexuality and about life, and then there's a dialogue that you can have with them, which is difficult to have at the best. We didn't have great conversations with our parents, probably. It's about that and also the schools and access to the internet. We're going to take a piece of music and talk about that then.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay, 'cause I've had Frisco before, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change, everything still remains the same. Sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.
Everybody's whistling here as well. We're talking to Dr. Coleman Nocter. Are you okay to use the doctor? And we've got a room full of people in a glass bubble, so if you hear voices, don't worry about it. We're all doing our best. We've got Reese. There's Delphine chatting away, and we're live on air. How are you? Delphine's looking after Twitter PR. And Ash, it's fine. Listen, we're doing our best. Lots of people listening this morning. Mason Forbes sending in songs that they like. Fight Song, Here Comes the Sun. That's a positive song. They're a good choice as well. And Anne Rabbit TD has been on as well. Don't worry, be happy. I think that was a good choice. Do you have a song, particularly, Coleman, that lifts your day if you're going to play it in the car?
No, the last time I was here, you ended with Nathan Carter Wagon Wheel insinuating that that was one of my favourite tracks, but it wouldn't be. But I just think any uplifting track.
Anyway, I have no control over the music this year, so you're okay, you're safe, and I doubt if Wagon Wheel is in there. Do you know what? I'll have a look, Rachel, just to say. We're talking about serious topics as well, but I think that's about life as well, about being, have a bit of fun as well. You're going to be co-presenting tomorrow with me.
I am, yeah.
Or you're going to be the senior presenter, and I'm going to be the junior, so I'm looking forward to that. We're going to be on 9 to 11, Dr. Coleman Nocter with his junior Shea Byrne on tomorrow as well. We were talking about internet pornography. We were talking about children and a narrative that they might have, or a dialogue they might have with their friends and the internet itself about relationships. What can I, as a parent, say? Look, I know you've seen this stuff, and I know definitely they have. If I was 12 and I had access to it, I would have accessed it. What kind of dialogue as a parent do we need to say about normalizing, maybe the wrong word, but a relationship, about having a normal relationship with somebody?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point of view, the days of throwing him a book and saying, have a read of that, are gone. The exposure is far
too... I know you know about this, or if you don't know about it, here's a book, and yeah. Come and ask me any questions. Nobody's going to go back and ask a question.
And that was the way I was taught. You know, you got a book and saw some awkward diagrams and then went and asked your friends. The problem is that your friends are not going to know any more than you do. So there has to be a responsible adult in this conversation. And it is about the uncomfortable opening up the topics of pornography. And like, a lot of the things around parenting have changed because, you know, for example, terrorism. We don't want to talk about to our children about terrorism, but we have to because they're exposed to that in the media and they're going to pick up wrong information. They're going to get more confused and they're going to get more troubled.
More anxious. Well, again to you, but I have the example at home. I have a 9-year-old who won't go to France on her holidays, even though we were going to go to France, because she is terrified after the Paris bombings. She's not that fond of going. She doesn't want to go. Not that we were going to go to the States, but she's like, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. She's really anxious about it.
But if you imagine you're an 11-year-old and you access pornography and you're looking at these images of, you know, the ferociousness of it, if that doesn't give you maturity fears that I actually want to delay and stop having to be that expected of me for both boys and girls, it's a fairly terrifying experience. So it's more likely to stir up a series of anxiety responses to being in relationships than as much as something more aggressive. And you know, in the confusion, accidents and incidents can happen. So you need to be the voice within your family and take the uncomfortable conversation and say, this is what intimacy is, and this is what a relationship is, and this is what is expected of you at various ages and through your life, and it's different to what you'll see on that screen. The storyline is concocted for the point of view of somebody to watch.
So this is the conversation now. I'm just, you know, if I'm looking at a worked example in a book, this is the kind of conversation I should be having. Listen, Jack, sit down. I want to talk to you about something. I know you've seen something on the internet, and I know you've seen naked women and naked men, and you've seen pornography, and
Get in there before the conversation. You know what I mean? In terms of, don't wait. Like, sometimes we give kids tablets and say, you know, off you go, come back to me when you have a problem. It's actually trying to get in there before and say, you might come across this. This is something that I know is going around schools and friendship groups. If you see these images, they're make-believe. They are completely make-believe, like movies that you'd see made in Hollywood. They do not reflect reality. The reality of relationships is this, and that you need to respect each other, and you need to respect each other's bodies, and you need to ensure that everybody is comfortable with anything that you engage in. And it's at that level, and you obviously have to increase the level of intensity or intricacies to those conversations as your child gets older. But unfortunately, society calls for those conversations earlier and probably in more depth than they ever did before. And I know some parents say, oh, I feel uncomfortable about that. If there's a cool uncle that might be able to have this chat, if you feel too uncomfortable having it with them, if you don't think you'd be very good at it and someone else might be better at it, get them to have that chat. Of course they'll eye roll and they'll find it uncomfortable and they'll go, Dad, or whatever it might be, but they leave the conversation with knowledge that they didn't have before. And children, despite the fact that they will say that you know nothing, will oftentimes take 60% of what you say as fairly gospel and well-informed. The idealized dad image that you had when they were 7 is still there somewhere. Have the conversation. Nobody regrets not having it, or having the conversation. People do regret not having it.
So mothers, conversation with sons, fathers having conversation with sons, fathers trying to have conversation with daughters.
Both. I mean, let's not pigeonhole this. If there's someone who you'll listen to, or someone who'll just put it away that makes sense, or somebody that will make that click or that information seem coherent to a child or a young person, go for it. And it's not just one conversation, it's a series of conversations over their lives. You know, this notion that we can all sit around the table once for 10 minutes and that's that sorted. The challenges will keep coming as...
So it's an ongoing conversation. Yeah. It's a bit of a buzzword, but it's an ongoing conversation.
And
something
it is.
Should we touch and base every... I know it's hard to put a time frame on it, but every couple of months, every month,
sure.
Or just have a conversation.
I think it's necessary. And that's not something you just let lie. You know, you need to come back to this as they get older as well.
I think as well, from speaking to you and others over the years as well, we always talk about have a dinner together. That's something that's not an easy thing to do, but something that a social gathering in the family where it makes it easy to talk about things as well. Do you have to engineer those kind of situations? Sometimes you're working, your wife's working, or your partner is working, you're working different times, you're not there, the kids all have 6 activities, someone's going to ballet and then they're going to I don't know, sure. Wood modeling class and then chess and everybody's together. Do you need to engineer social situations where you can all sit down together?
Unfortunately, you do. And that gets back to the point that I think the seduction of technology is, technology is based on the fact of time on screen. So this is the notion that Facebook and all the social media companies, all they're interested in is you spending more time on screen. So they are designed in order for you to keep your attention. There's an arms race for an attention. That's what they are. You're involved in that as a parent in that arms race. You have to fight for the attention for your child away from the screen. And the issue is that, if, again, getting back to, let's say, for example, Google and Apple are the town planners of a village that a billion people inhabit. There is no ethical need for them to have wider sidewalks, to have zebra crossings. They will give you whatever you want. So if you like donuts and you click on donuts, they'll give you donuts all day long. So your child who's, you know, clicking on something, they'll just get more and more and more of that. So you do have to engineer time to interrupt that. You need to engineer children to be able to be critical consumers of the information that they get. The whole fake news phenomena, you know, we only found that out after elections and things like that. And in terms of, you need to actually structure in the times to educate your child on a different conversation than the one they're getting online. And that, if that means creating sacred spaces, and somebody spoke about that this morning, if that's a sacred space, then every other space is unsafe in some respects. You need to do that, because we have to take responsibility to teach children how to develop a relationship with technology. When I did my research, what came through is that our relationships with our technology, much like food, alcohol, they differ from person to person. So some kid will take up the iPad and they'll get engaged with, and you say it's time up, they'll hand it back and they'll go out and play football. No problem at all. The other child who's growing up in the same family will be like, you can get this from my cold dead hands. You know, there's a kind of a temper tantrum, etc. And in some ways, you know, what you drink doesn't make you an alcoholic, but why you drink does. And what is it about this engagement online that children are, that vulnerable children are investing so heavily in the likes and in the comments? And it's the child who's more vulnerable to that level of influence who needs it more, is the child who'll need to be parented differently. So it's not about time spent on screen, an hour a day is it. That information I would have given you 2 years ago is obsolete. It's actually trying to tailor the relationship your child has with the device and what they're doing. And you are, you know, if you could, the psychology of persuasion is nothing new. You go into any supermarket and you'll meet met with the breads and the confectioneries, and the last aisle is the detergent and stuff. So they want to play to your senses so that you'll buy more bread. In terms of, in if you look on Netflix or the autoplay the next video, they're trying to keep you online. If you're on Facebook and you get a happy birthday, Shay, and they know that your psychology is to say happy birthday back, then they're going to give you loads of that. If you're someone, potentially, these companies are scheduling our lives. They're scheduling our choice architecture. So if you like outrage and you click a lot of outrageous anti-Trump stuff, let's say, for example, then we'll send you outrage all day. So we'll leave you in a position of outrage all day. And if you're not questioning that, then you won't be able to switch off or check out. And to expect children to be able to do that, you know, if an app has a high regret level, so you go, oh my God, I spent 3 hours today on Candy Crush or whatever it is, the higher the regret level of an app is the success of its technology. So they want us to regret more. And we need to have the conversation in our head that doesn't allow us to engage in that, that questions it, that actually we need to become the town planners of our own architecture, our own choice architecture. And to expect children to do that is just too much.
So give me, we've got about 5 minutes left, give me some strategies. Other than buying your book, give me some.
I mean, the strategy is teaching people to be critical consumers of technology. You know,
to say to them, look, this is what these people are trying to make you watch this. I remember saying 3 or 4 years ago to somebody, one of the kids in McDonald's, and fast food restaurants in general, but one of the McDonald's, that they have this up, and they go, "Oh, I'd love that." I say, "That's what they want you to do. They are selling you something. They're not your friend. They are selling you something." And I have to remember, every time we go in there and we see something, they go, oh, look, they're trying to sell us an ice cream because it's only a euro extra as well. Is that something we try?
That's brilliant. And in terms of, we need to be able to do that for children online so they become critical consumers of, like, say, for example, the McDonald's toy. The whole point of that is appealing to a child's collectibles. A child likes to have all five. So each week they'll release one more, which means you have to go to McDonald's every week. And on the last week, they don't have that last one. You have to come next week. Oh, we're all out of that one. You have to come the next week. So you've got 5 extra weeks of trying to collect that toy, and lo and behold, there's a new collection starting again. So you're appealing to a child's pester power and their ability to say, I need to get that last Angry Birds piece of plastic. That's amazing. And so you're being drawn back into that again. So you get a child to be able to be a critical consumer of that, because if you're online and you like donuts, it's like when you wake up in the morning, there's a donut on your bedside locker, and then you go up and there's porridge.
Where is this paradise?
But do you know what I mean? It's the data we give to these companies gives us back, and it gives it back without any ethical obligation. That's the key. So you have to give your child an internal ethical structure to be able to question this.
Do you know what, Coleman? But me as an adult, do I need to first figure out what my relationship is with online? I think that might be a bit of a problem.
That is the first step, and I say this, and it's when I give talks, it's always the moment where it gets really uncomfortable, where you kind of say, look, guys, we can't blame the kids on this anymore. The biggest population to move onto Facebook are white professionals between the ages of 35 and 55. We've taken a kind of, if you can't beat them, join them approach to it. And if you're saying, and this is the sad part, 5 years ago we would have sat here, Shay, and I would have said, I have parents coming to me all the time saying, I can't access my daughter because she's stuck behind the screen. Unfortunately now, I have teenagers saying, I can't access my mam because she's stuck behind the screen. And that reversal is pretty tragic from the point of view of, and if you're saying you'll turn off your Xbox while you're sending emails over breakfast, it's like saying eat your porridge while I have a packet of crisps. It just won't work. The buy-in isn't there. And so it has to be something that's in the fabric of the culture of the family, that I respect the need to question this stuff and I question the need to regulate it. If your house is just full of junk food and there's, you know, cereals, bars and everything all over the place, then how do you expect your child to manage that or to regulate themselves?
Were you in my house? That's what
I just heard rumors. But you know, from the point of view of it's a fabric piece.
Maybe a simple lead by example?
That's where to start. But I think we have to question this stuff. It's so insipid. It becomes part of our lives without us even knowing it. And we become kind of hooked, I would say, and I use that loosely, into this stuff and reliant on it. And I got this question, you know, I'd rather think there'll be a revolution where we'll all just put down our screens, and I think, no, I don't think, I think we're too hooked already. So
it's not a matter of cutting them off.
No, learn how to deal with it.
And lead by example, maybe. Exactly. Look at yourself first. I'm going home to look at myself now.
Question.
Oh, thanks, God. It's been a more terrible for half hour talking to you about things.
No, but I think some people say talk. That's really good. But also we have to remember to question. Because sometimes we need to talk to ourselves and ask ourselves why.
Dr. Coleman Nocter, thank you so much for coming in and giving us that time as well. Psychoanalytical psychotherapist at Primary Care Psychotherapy in Nace, as well as being here and other places as well, and teaching as well. So thanks. You're coming to co-present tomorrow.
I am. Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to seeing you anxious and upset on this side of the desk for a change.
Be prepared.
Well, that's the end of our show today. Thanks so much for listening. We're here again 9 to 11 tomorrow, myself and Coleman presenting the show. Lots of great guests on tomorrow. Thanks to everybody who's helped us, big production team here as well. My producer, Liz Sweeney, a colleague from RTE, Rachel on sound and technicals, and our researchers and PR, and everybody is working away as well. Laura Woods and Dustin the Turkey are coming up next here on Walk In My Shoes Radio. Let's take a track and have a nice day, and talk to you soon. Take care.